time, Justice Sherry has rejoined us at this point, and Justice Givens again will participate after reviewing the record and oral argument in this matter. This is Granada Ruiz Gambino versus District Court 72446. And counsel, Mr. Robert Arroyo, if you proceed.
May it please the court, Robert Arroyo, on behalf of Mr. Granada Ruiz, who's present today as well at counsel table, is Jernell Thomas with me as well. The U.S. Supreme Court has continually noted, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if that's the court's pleasure. The United Supreme Court has continually noted that when granting a mistrial, district courts must use their sound discretion. They've said that the power to declare a mistrial should be used with the greatest caution under urgent circumstances. The statement is in recognition that the defendant has a very important right to have his trial completed by a specific jury and to have his conflict with the state concluded. In this case, we had a trial that lasted about 2 weeks. Numerous exhibits, numerous witnesses, countless hours spent by counsel preparing, and in the end, the decision to grant the mistrial was made in one afternoon, admittedly by a judge who said that she was unprepared and never dealt with this issue in all her time practicing law, and by defense counsel who had sufficient experience, they said that they've never encountered this experience before as well.
Didn't the court query counsel to do some research and come back to the court?
The state did offer their opinion of what the district court should do. There was research that was done. The record's not clear how long the actual break was. There was a discussion that was done on the record prior to Mr. Granada Ruiz being present. And during that time, they kind of discussed which way they were going to go once they learned about the juror misconduct. There was research that was done during the break. And so when they came back from recess, the state cited to Meyer v. State, and the defense had cited to Zana v. State. But I don't think the record shows how much time they actually had to research in this case. Is our position that more time should have been taken by the district court to allow sufficient research for this court to get up to speed, for defense counsel to get up to speed, and to talk with their client and get him up to speed with things. I think the misconduct came to the court's attention at 3:00 in the afternoon. I'm not sure why the court couldn't go into recess for the afternoon, give counsel time to research it, come back in the morning, and be prepared to make arguments on how to proceed. Double jeopardy should bar a second trial of Mr. Granada Ruiz in this situation due to the lack of caution and sound discretion.
Counsel, the position at the court, the defense counsel seemed to be agreeing with the court when the court expressed its concerns about going forward with this juror. As I recall, it was the state who was offering alternatives, suggesting that maybe everybody should slow down, let's bring in each juror. And the defense was not saying, hey, I agree with the state, let's slow this down. They're saying, yeah, it's very concerning, we share the court's concerns. How's that not even implied consent after this all played out? And Mr. Granada was present subsequent.
I would agree that initially the state was the party that was offering up suggestions and alternatives and the correct standard to proceed. I don't think this rises to a level of implied consent. In Benson, this court said you have to take the totality of the circumstances. Silence or failure to object is not, it doesn't equal implied consent. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances. In this case, you had defense counsel that gave conflicting statements. On one hand, she did say I somewhat agree with the court that this prejudice has permeated the jury. But on the other hand, she admits, hey, I'm flummoxed and I'm not prepared for the issue. I think it's important, though, that Mr. Granada Ruiz wasn't there. He wasn't consulted initially by the court. it was during that first meeting with the court and defense counsel and the state that the determination was made how they were going to proceed. And so the district court had already determined at that stage that we were going to proceed two ways. If the information by juror three was shared with the rest of the jury, I think we need a mistrial. If it wasn't shared, then we'll explore alternatives.
But how do we invoke double jeopardy when defense counsel didn't do anything wrong, the prosecutor didn't do anything wrong, the judge really didn't do anything wrong, it was juror misconduct, which happens quite a bit. And would you really want us to say that every time there's juror misconduct, that the case should stop and that we should do exactly what the district attorney proposed?
I don't think we are advocating for a bright line rule like that. But in this case, we believe that the district court should exercise a little bit more discretion and caution before declaring a mistrial. So there should be a sufficient procedure done on the record prior to declaring the mistrial. I think that is where our biggest complaint lies.
Excuse me, this is Justice Perigieri in Carson City. What specific procedure would you propose? They discussed this in some detail and at length. Everybody was concerned about declaring a mistrial. None of us like to do it as district court judges. But sometimes it's a manifest necessity.
I think the case law would support that there isn't a mechanical rule that district courts have to go through prior to declaring a mistrial. But they should apply the correct legal standard. So we would just think that before declaring a mistrial, the proper legal standard should be considered and discussed. In this case, there should have been some discussion of whether or not juror three, there could have been alternatives. I mean, in this case, there was really no alternatives discussed.
I don't think you should switch sides with the DA because this was a great defense victory, a mistrial in a murder case. But we had juror misconduct. I don't understand where you're coming from to challenge Judge Delaney's ruling. I think she did exactly what I would expect her to do. Imagine if he had been convicted of murder and had come up here on the issue of whether a mistrial should have been declared. I mean, you know, he could have been nailed with a murder conviction on the basis of a faulty jury finding because of legal research by jurors.
And I believe that that's a fear that defense counsel has, but it's Mr. Granada Ruiz's right to continue. I'm not suggesting that either side has a right to continue with a biased jury, but he should have been consulted at least, and it is his right despite defense counsel's concern.
But the defense counsel raised concern? Did the defense counsel scream, I want to go forward, my client wants to go forward? Was there anything on the record to support that?
I would concede that there isn't, but I believe the case law implied consent doesn't require that. Consent has to be determined by totality of the circumstances, and which I explained that under these circumstances where you have a judge that comes out and tells defense counsel, this is my decision to make, talk to your client, but let him know that this is going to be my decision, basically forecloses any objection would have been futile at that point after the judge made her decision that she was ultimately going to decide the issue of prejudice.
When I practiced, it was a special public defender or a Clark County public defender or a contract attorney. We didn't have iPhones that we had to worry about jurors doing research. So we're in a new technology now. And even though a judge can instruct the jury, you're not supposed to even do anything with your legal research. Sometimes if you say it, then people want to do it anyway just to see what they can get away with. I think by affirming or by denying your petition, we're giving safe harbor to judges to say, if this happens, it's okay to grant a mistrial. It's okay. You're not going to worry about double jeopardy. If we find in your favor, every judge is going to be hesitant to grant the mistrial, and we're going to have some people be convicted when there's been juror misconduct. That's what I worry about as a former defense attorney and as an appellate judge. So if you could respond to that.
I would just say if the court goes through the proper procedure and displays sound discretion, proper legal standards, then there shouldn't be any double guessing or second guessing of the trial judge. But here, we can't allow judges to not employ the correct legal standard and then tell them that their decisions would be insulated just because we have a concern about, down the road that there would be other mistrials upheld.
But it'd be so much easier if defense counsel had made a record, a proper record, as to why the case should continue, why this juror misconduct was not so so terrible that there should be a mistrial. That's what I'm missing in the record here. And bad facts make bad law. Just remember that.
And I would agree that a better record should have been made, but that's why the judge should have stepped back, taken a couple, recess for the night, let counsel go ahead and do some research, give counsel time to confirm Mr. Granado Ruiz. And that was not done in this. I mean, when you're in the thick of things and...
I want to bring it back to before you found out it was 11-1 for not guilty. If you had a little more time, what research would have been uncovered that would have informed your decision whether to object or not object? And it seems like the biggest motivating factor, which I understand, is that when it ended, it was 11-1 for not guilty. Right? So what, taking that out, what we know now, at the time of these conversations, which of the four Chapman factors that inform sound discretion was missing? Were both parties heard? Yes. They both brought cases? Yes. Did the judge consider alternatives? Yes. Was it an abrupt decision? You're suggesting it was. I might suggest that's a little bit belied by the record, but maybe that's your piece. And was the mistrial based on evidence in the record? And it was. The court stated the factors, took testimony from two jurors about the breadth of this disclosure. So what's missing, or what am I missing?
I would disagree with almost all those points, respectfully. I would argue that the district court did not consider alternatives. The alternatives were under a wrong legal standard. It's if there was no consideration of can we bring in an alternate and give a curative instruction, remove the juror that had committed the misconduct. The only alternative was if the information wasn't shared, it wasn't considered if it was shared. I would argue that it was abrupt. The decision was made even before Mr. Granado Ruiz showed up. There was no change in the decision. There's no indication that the court even read Meyer or Zano that were proffered by the state.
And counsel was agreeing with the court's concerns. You talked about the permeated issue, but your counsel said, this is a huge issue. It is like the issue. So you're running in tandem with the court. I don't want to take all your time for rebuttal. I'm just, if you can just think about that.
And just real quick, I would just argue that the decision wasn't based upon the evidence induced during the hearing. I think the court made some errors interpreting that. I believe Juror 10 kept stating that, yes, we did deliberate about Juror 3's research, but it was in the context of telling them you're not supposed to do that research. At the oral argument on the motion to dismiss, the court even admitted, she says, that's not how I took it. I took it as they were deliberating on this evidence. And if the other jurors had been telling Juror 3 you shouldn't have done it, it would have been different. I think if you go back and look at the record, Juror 10 was clear that every time it came up, it was them fighting back saying you shouldn't have done that research. And I would like to keep my time for rebuttal.
We chewed up your time a little bit, counsel. You have 1:52. We'll give you an even 3 minutes when you can stand back up. We'll give the state an additional minute if they need such in their response to the court. Ms. Canizario, on behalf of the state.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nicole Canizaro, and I am a Chief Deputy District Attorney, the Clark County District Attorney's Office, representing the respondent in this matter, the State of Nevada. Your Honor, the case before you presents the very real question of in what circumstances a manifest necessity exists, and to what extent defense counsel has to object to the declaration of a mistrial when the court has indicated that it has found manifest necessity. The state would submit that in this particular case, Your Honors, the court did conduct a thorough investigation regarding the deliberations in this particular case. In fact, the court canvassed three separate jurors regarding some extrinsic evidence that was presented by juror number 3 during the course of the weekend over deliberations. The court, while it did not originally, outline the Meyer factors, which I think is in some fashion putting form over substance. The court nevertheless went through those factors, and I think with respect to Justice Stiglitz's point regarding the Chapman factors, the state's position is that all of those were equally satisfied in this particular case. While the Double Jeopardy Clause does typically prevent the retrial of a defendant when, in fact, there has been an abuse of discretion by the district court in declaring a mistrial, that is not present in this particular case. Specifically, I want to talk about the procedural issues with the whether the court declared a mistrial. First and foremost, with respect to the Chapman factors, in this particular case, the question is whether or not the court actually heard the opinions of counsel as to whether or not other alternatives should be considered, whether or not there was a propriety for the mistrial, whether they acted deliberately or abruptly, and whether or not the mistrial was based on the evidence that was presented in the record. In this particular case, when the court became aware that the jurors had been discussing this outside research that was conducted by juror number three, the court did indicate to counsel prior to the defendant arriving to the courtroom that it thought that it needed to conduct a canvass of the jurors, that if the information that was researched was presented to the remaining jurors and was substantially discussed, that likely we might be in the position of a mistrial. I think that what is being overlooked by counsel is that in this case, the judge at that point had not made a determination. Judge Delaney indicated that if that's where we were, that's the direction that she may go. But in any event, she did consider canvassing the jurors. She indicated to counsel that she also would consider the potential of seating an alternate and then instructing the jury. And so at that point, it was not that the court was saying a mistrial was absolutely going to happen. At that point, the court was indicating that depending on what happened as a result of the canvass of the jurors, that potentially we may be in a situation where there could be a mistrial.
Where was the defendant?
Your Honor, through you and to the, through Mr. Chief Justice, to you, Justice Cherry.
Thank you, Senator.
At the time in which the parties were originally called to court, the defendant was on his way. Understandably, sometimes in court cases, counsel is much closer to the courthouse than a party may be, and so it took him some time to get there. What I would note about the record and what I would direct the court to is that when we originally showed up in front of Judge Delaney, she gave an overlay of what had happened. That we had received this note from the juror, that she had read through those notes, and that it was her intention to talk to the jurors, and that potentially we might be facing a mistrial.
Well, let's say that we find that it was error to not to proceed without the defendant being present at all, to have any type of record. Tell me why it would be harmless and not structural.
And, Your Honor, it would be harmless in this particular instance. Because the court did conduct a thorough canvass, and I also want to note that when the defendant did arrive at court, when he eventually showed up, counsel was given an opportunity to meet with him, counsel was given an opportunity to talk with him, and when the parties got back on the record, you will see that the court again talked about what had happened, that there had been a note prior to the particular notes that we were discussing, that the juror had had some medical issues, that those had been addressed by medical staff, that they had continued to deliberate, and that at some point the court then received a note that the jury was deadlocked 11-1, and subsequent to that had received two additional notes indicating that the juror number three had shared some extrinsic evidence, and also a note from juror number 12 that he had discussed that evidence with juror number three. So in this particular instance, the defendant was actually told by the court what was going to happen, that they were going to canvass the jurors, and then potentially would be looking at a mistrial situation. So there was nothing that happened outside of the defendant's presence that didn't also happen in his presence once he arrived at the courthouse. Additionally, I would note that upon questioning of the jurors, when the parties were taking breaks to look at the case law and to discuss what alternatives we may be facing, Mr. Granada Ruiz was present with counsel, and in the record, the court also indicates that it was given Mr. Granada Ruiz an opportunity to talk with counsel about what was happening, to answer any of his questions. Mr. Granada Ruiz responded that he may have questions about the mistrial itself, but nothing that he didn't think should be addressed with his counsel outside of the fact. So in this particular case, there was nothing that happened without the defendant's presence, or that happened that he was not aware of, or that happened without him being able able to answer questions by counsel or the court.
So, Ms. Cannizzaro, outside of how we evaluate the court's decision, do you believe that totality of the circumstances show implied consent?
Yes, Your Honor. The state's position would be that in this particular case, there was implied consent by defense counsel at the time of trial. Now, it seems that there's a big discussion about whether or not the court indicated it was going to grant a mistrial, and that was the court's decision. While Judge Delaney did make that statement, prior to even making that statement, the parties discussed alternatives. The state suggested that there was another case. Mr. Pallal, in fact, advised the court he had been in another case recently in front of Judge Thompson, that during the course of that trial, there was some extrinsic evidence that was discussed by some of the jurors, and then in that particular instance, they had canvassed the jurors, they had instructed the jurors, and sent them back to deliberate. At that point, defense counsel makes a record of the fact that they believe that that is frightening. That is frightening that that would be the course of action that the court would take. That is absolutely implied consent, I think, even in and of itself. But to further that, as the court's discussion goes along, defense counsel at various times does make a record that they did not believe that seating an alternate juror would suffice because the jury had spent so much time deliberating about this particular outside research, even to the extent that when juror number 10 was canvassed, the foreperson, he indicated that the jury had actually supplanted the court's own instructions and had focused a substantial part of their deliberations on the research that was done by juror number 3. And so when the court asked juror number 10 specifically, did you go back to the court's instructions, which you were told, and did you, in fact, look at those instructions and disregard what juror number 3 had brought to you all? He says, no, at some point, it became a discussion simply about what juror number 3 had researched.
Ms. Counselor, let me, so that totality piece. Now let's see, we're evaluating the judge's decision under an abuse of discretion standard. Certainly at the time of trial, the state was very supportive of the position the defense is taking now, that the judge should have taken alternative steps, been more deliberate in that process. You were alone in doing that. So how do we evaluate now under abuse of discretion? Here you're coming in and saying, we argued something totally different down below, but we think it's fine now.
Yes, Your Honor. The state did argue during trial that there were, and we cited to Meyer specifically, that there were potentially other alternatives that should be discussed, that we should take the time to potentially canvass the jurors, and that if their judgment was not affected by the outside research, that there could be a curative instruction. However, I think that when you look at the record in this particular case, once we've gone through the canvass of the jurors, at the end, all of the parties were in the same position that we have now heard not only was there outside research that was conducted, there was outside research that was shared with the foreperson before they even entered the courthouse. And that had to do with the blood alcohol content, and it also had to do with the extrinsic evidence regarding premeditation and deliberation and different definitions of self-defense and how it pertains to murder cases. Then part of that research entered into the deliberation room, and not to the extent that you may see in some of these other cases, and specifically, I believe that there were a number of cases where the jury had been told that a juror had done outside research, but then elected to disregard it. In this particular circumstance, all three of the jurors that were canvassed indicated that they had substantially discussed the research, that at some point they were going back and forth. The foreperson testified that it became very contentious in the jury deliberation room because of this outside research. And so at the point that the canvass had been completed, I think the court, the state, and the defense were all of the position that in this particular instance, this extrinsic evidence had absolutely affected the jury deliberation. And therefore, it would be impossible to have given a curative instruction because at this point, it had become so infected by that and had been so discussed.
Now, you do understand, Ms. Cannizzaro, that if you prevail in this matter, and I'm glad Mr. Owens is in this courtroom, because every time there's going to be juror misconduct, if this opinion denies the petition, if an opinion denies this petition, you're going to be seeing this case cited, that there's a safe harbor for these judges, these district court judges, somebody like Judge Delaney, who was not known for her practicing criminal law, rather she was a civil attorney in her day. Gives them a safe harbor to just grant mistrials. So is this what the district attorney wants to accomplish in this case? Again, bad facts make bad law. And like I said, I think you're on the, you, you should reverse your seating capacity. They should be over here and you should be over there. So you should be to my left and they should be to my right. Do you understand what's going to happen if we deny this petition?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think
especially on 11-1 for not guilty.
Yes, Your Honor. And so 2 points that I would make. First and foremost, this case is very different from even the other cases that have been presented before this court, wherein a juror's done some outside research, but a bailiff stops them prior to entering the courthouse. Where a juror does outside research, and they present it to the remaining jurors, but those jurors disregard that research. This case represents the very instance in which this court should not grant the petition and where a mistrial was absolutely done out of manifest necessity. Because the facts of this case are different than saying, because a juror did outside research, there must be a mistrial. The facts of this case indicate that in this particular circumstance, this research was part and parcel of the juror deliberations. I understand also, as to my second point, that in this particular case, we are talking about 11 jurors who were of the opinion of not guilty and one juror who was of the opinion of guilty. But in this particular case, the question before this court is not whether or not the jurors were 11-1 not guilty and was that close enough. The question for this court is whether or not that extrinsic research was so part and parcel of the jury deliberations that it infected that and it was impermissible and thus mandated that it was manifest necessity to declare a mistrial. In this particular case, that is absolutely what we have before us. And I would note that during the course of this, I don't think any of the parties were of the opinion that that was going to be what the jurors told us in terms of the stance of their deliberations. So when a court is conducting this particular inquiry, a court, and this court, would have to look to whether or not the process itself was impermissibly invalidated by the fact that they did this extrinsic research, not whether or not the jury ended up being 11-1 not guilty. I think that is part of the facts of this case, and it's in large part why we're present before Your Honors today arguing on this petition. I think if the result had been different, we might not be here. But the process in this case, prior to us even getting that result, and I think that that speaks to why Judge Delaney did not abuse her discretion and why she, in fact, did at least touch on all of these factors, even if she didn't say, we're going to go through Meyer factor number one and, you know, talk about how pervasive this particular information was. Even defense counsel conceded that this information was very pervasive and that at the point where we had done the canvass of the jurors, that there was really no other position than a mistrial. And I think that that's important for this court to consider
as well. So in the absence of the judge making a statement that appeared to convey that she'd already made up her mind, the process that Judge Delaney engaged in nevertheless would have been consistent with the process you would expect any district court judge to use.
Yes, Your Honor. We talked about not only the type of research, where it came from, how long it was discussed. The jurors indicated that they began discussing that information as a body prior to the note that was received by the court at 11:30 a.m. They were then in deliberations until 3 p.m., so we are talking about several hours worth of deliberations. We talked about how pervasive it was, that it had in fact become part and parcel of the deliberations to the point that they were going back and forth and it became contentious, and that at that point it was very difficult for even some of the jurors to separate that. So I think in this particular circumstance, if the judge had not said, I think we might be looking at a mistrial, but for that statement, which the state's position is, was not definitive at that point, this would be a very different situation.
One other question, if you would, Ms. Cannizzaro. How did the research, I wasn't clear on this, diverge so dramatically from the instruction itself?
And, Your Honor, when we did canvass the juror, it was very difficult to get him to articulate what exactly he had researched, but that he was refusing to look at the court's instruction. And so I know that in the reply, the petitioner did indicate that the state had not addressed this. The state actually did address this in our answer, Your Honors, and I would direct you to, I apologize, page 30 of the state's answer, wherein we discuss whether or not that instruction was so similar to the instruction, whether that research was so similar to the instructions that were given by the court. When the court conducted the canvass, this juror indicated that he had questions. He had questions about the instruction. He didn't believe that that matched what he believed the party had argued at closing at closing arguments. He also indicated he had done some research, shared that research, but was not going to listen to the court's instruction, and it was very difficult for him to articulate exactly what those differences were, just that he didn't agree with the instructions. And that had been part and parcel of the jury's deliberation.
And the foreperson didn't identify what the nature of this research was either.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I see that I am running out of time. May I finish answering your question?
Go ahead and finish, please.
Thank you. So the foreperson indicated that they had discussed premeditation and deliberation, and that they had discussed that he and juror number three had discussed prior to entering the courthouse blood alcohol content level, that part of the discussions had been around self-defense and premeditation and deliberation. Defense counsel indicated that is the issue in this case. I would also note that in Bowman, this court indicated that even when a juror conducted an outside experience that just reaffirmed what they had previously believed during the deliberations, that that in and of itself was enough to warrant a mistrial.
It's just an awkward situation, I'm sure, for the judge and counsel to handle when it's not at all clear what the big divergence was. I mean, were they debating whether the facts matched up with the jury instruction? The juror can't articulate what supposedly the outside information was that shifted the gears. I don't know. I don't know that the judge or counsel could have done much more here to ferret it out, but I guess the other question I had was nobody ever offered a curative instruction or even discussed the language for a curative instruction. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We did not. I would note that prior to us beginning the canvas of the jurors, that was something that was discussed as a possibility, but ultimately after the canvas.
Just as an option, but no
correct.
Language or whatever was discussed.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, if you'd reset the clock at 4 minutes instead of three, in light of the additional time. Counsel, you have 4 minutes. You don't have to speak quite as fast.
Thank you. I think I would agree with the state in that our focus should be on the process. It shouldn't be a hindsight on whether it was 11-1 for acquittal, 11-1 for guilty. It really shouldn't play any factor into this decision. It should be on the process, and that's where Judge Delaney erred on this case. I would note that this juror research was not material to the deliberations. It didn't differ from what the prosecutor argued in closing arguments.
Defense counsel argued it was material, that it was the issue in the case. That's what your side argued in front of Judge Delaney.
I would concede, yes, that she did say that she did say that. But if you look back at the record, there's no support for that statement.
What's the district court judge supposed to do? Counsel says this is serious. It's the issue in the case. I mean, you probe the juror who was involved in this. You can't get that juror to be too much more specific. But counsel's saying this is serious, this is bad. I mean, the judge is on the horns of a dilemma. If you don't grant a mistrial, you face that probability that you committed error when it's brought up on appeal, as Justice Cherry has suggested. I'm struggling to find the abuse of discretion by the trial judge here.
My response would be, what was the rush? I mean, why did they need to come to a decision by the end of the day on that day?
The question is, though, what did defense counsel proffer? Defense counsel said, Your Honor, would you give us additional time to do some research? That is not in the record. So the parties themselves never made this statement to the court, give us some time to take a look. The court gave them a little time to see if they could come up with something. It might not have been a great amount, but little. Counsel on the other side never said, we'd like some time. As you said, what is the rush? They didn't say that. You're saying it's probably great, but they should have said it. It would have been better.
It makes it easier for us if there's a record on both sides. In other words, Ms. Cannizzaro has certainly presented what the district attorneys did to prevent the mistrial. But it seems like the record's silent from the defense as to what was happening, which is unusual for defense attorneys, by the way.
And my response would be that the case law puts the burden on discretion, sound discretion, with the court. So it's ultimately the court's decision, because neither party consented to a mistrial. That's a specific finding that was made by the district court in this case, that neither side consented. This was going to be the district court's decision. That's where I think if the district
court... But counsel, when it's all said and done at the end of the day, the court does make the decision. I was looking at the words used, and the court just basically said, no, I make the decision. But that means you provide the court with facts to make the decision. That seems to be the rub.
Yeah, and the court did have, the benefit of the evidentiary hearing with the jurors, and I believe that the decision made by the trial court, even looking back, if we say that the trial court didn't make up its mind prior to the questioning of the jurors, even afterwards, I think it's clear that the prejudice hadn't permeated the jury. Looking at this record, there's no support for the judge's decision.
Why isn't that part of the judicial discretion? And you said nobody consented to this mistrial. Well, nobody objected either, right?
That's correct. Nobody objected, expressed or a specific objection, but I mean, that brings us back into implied consent, where the lack of objection isn't determinative on implied consent.
Counsel, your time is almost up, so give us your closing thought of what you want this court to do and why.
I would just argue that Mr. Granada Ruiz has a very important right to have his trial concluded by a specific tribunal. The court gave no consideration to that right before making the abrupt decision under a wrong legal standard to grant a mistrial. And because of that, I don't believe Mr. Granada Ruiz should be subject to the consequences of a public trial again, and the double jeopardy clause should bar re-prosecution.
Thank you. Court thanks counsel for their arguments. Just a clarifying. We also note the president is our new special public defender. Good morning. We stand in recess.